When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So where are we right now with vaccines? Well, Italy doesn't want Australia to get the vaccines it needs. Europe for a while didn't want the UK to get some of the vaccines it was making as well. France didn't want its old people to get a British vaccine, perhaps because they were worried they'd suddenly acquire a taste for Yorkshire pudding. And in the United States, President Biden has now said there's going to be enough vaccines for everyone in the country by the end of May. He didn't actually say that they would be distributed and jabbed in the arms by then. They'll just have enough vaccines ready to go, which is great. But what about the poor countries? Don't we realise until it is wiped out or at least substantially reduced everywhere, it's going to stick around forever? Today, vaccination is a global game on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. So, a rapid rollout of the vaccine in the UK, the largest vaccine programme in history for the UK, 2 million or so people every week, over 21 million people so far have had the jab, with the aims that all adults would be given it by the end of July. Israel well ahead in terms of jabs per head, or jabs per arm it should really be, but a much smaller population, of course, and Europe falling behind, mainly because they delayed negotiations because they're trying to get a better price. They're paying half the price that Israel paid for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, but is this a time to be quibbling over dollars and cents? But Steve, there is little point in the West vaccinating itself if we leave ourselves open to reinfections or the virus evolving in places where people haven't been vaccinated in other countries, because as the World Health Organization puts it, nobody wins the race until everyone wins the race.
No, not by a long shot. And this is the classic thing. A lot of ideology and a lot of colonial politics lies behind the way we treat the third world. And the virus couldn't give a rat's ass. Yeah, but couldn't give a rat's ass about our political and colonial systems. It just wants to breed somewhere, and evolve. And, we talk about the virus as if it's a living entity. In fact, it's an undead. It has to be inside a human body or a body to reproduce. But of course, because it can reproduce inside a human body and it reproduces inside any being with a cell structure, then the pressure we put it under by our own attempts to suppress it can lead to it evolving in directions that we're not ready for. So if you give it the whole of... And because it's so transmissible, this is the other thing. People, I think, often think in terms of Ebola, and Ebola didn't get out of Africa, so why should we worry about COVID? If COVID infects Africa, that's Africa's problem. But the thing is, if this stuff can continue, being transmitted and changing, while it's so transmissible in another region, then it can come back in a different and more dangerous form.
Well, if it comes back and it's as dangerous as Ebola is, then we are with the infection rate it's got, then we are all done for, aren't we? Basically,
that's hell.
Cockroaches will rule the earth. Absolutely. Let's hope we don't get to that. But I mean, the problem, I guess, in the third world or in developing nations is that whereas we in the West are, because we've all got these bullshit jobs that allow us to work from home and look at our computer screens and talk to each other about moving money around and all that sort of stuff. In developing nations, they don't do that. They're actually at work in the factory or in the fields or in the streets, and they are in contact with each other, and they don't often have the option to sit at home and self-isolate because they need money to survive. So,
mind you, let's not forget at the moment the third world's doing a damn sight better than the first in terms of managing this virus. I'm just looking at the Indian data right now. I remember looking at India's trajectory from April to October, from April to August was looking absolutely appalling. It went from if you go right back to early April, it was running at about 1,000, like actually late the end of March, 146 cases at the end of March. that was less, substantially less than the UK and Netherlands at the time with, you know, far smaller populations. It was heading towards 100K and I was thinking it was going to be up to a million at some point. It peaked in September at about 96,000 cases. India has now driven its cases per day down to about 10,000 to 15,000. So
are they testing as many though? I mean, that was
the testing. But the thing is, you can't, because this is such a virulent virus. If you're not testing as many and it's still spreading, it will ultimately overwhelm your numbers anyway. And in terms of the number of deaths, for example, like in terms of India's deaths per day, they peaked at 1,300 people in September, and they're now down to 100 a day. So that is, let's compare it to the UK right now. The UK is running at 800 a day. So you've got...
And that's good.
We're
celebrating that. Exactly.
So the third world's doing far better, but it will
still be... So why is that then? Because the scenario I was describing, you imagine it would be very difficult for the third world to put in place the sorts of measures that we've seen in countries like the UK, which, you know, seems like we've been in lockdown almost every week for the last year, apart from a little brief summer last year. So how come they're doing it so much better? What's different?
Well, I hate to put a juvenile characterization on it, but it's basically what can happen with a disciplined young child versus a bunch of spoiled brats. I mean, the way that the West is behaving, you can't take my liberty away. You don't have fantasies about liberty in India to the same degree. So you have, if your police direction comes out, you follow the police direction, because it's not particularly good for your health to refuse it. And there's more of an experience in handling massive levels of, you know, they have cholera outbreaks. So you've got to, when that happens, you're told, you know, boil the water, don't do this, don't do that, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a realization that you have to follow those rules, otherwise you'll be overwhelmed by it. So that, because you're closer to the ground where these things happen than people living in cities like London and New York are, then there's more obedience, more following the public health directives. And I must admit, I'm surprised. I would not have predicted this. It's remarkable to see. But India has been far more successful at turning us around than any of the developed nations. And India only ranks number two to the USA because it's got four times the United States population. You look at the ranking right now, and I look at this and I find a lot of people mustn't be looking at it for the sort of nonsense comments I'm getting from people in America and the UK right now about COVID policy. The USA has currently got roughly 28 million cases. India has 11, Brazil has 10, and the UK has 4. Now, the UK is, what, 1/6 the size of Brazil, 1/20 the size of India, 1/6 the size of USA. So if you factor in even Brazil on a per capita basis is doing better than the UK, even with, you know, a right-wing jerk as its political leader. The third world has done...
Oh, so you're talking about Brazil there. I thought you were talking... Yes.
Yeah.
Same thing applies. Yeah.
Same difference.
So how do we... But how... Obviously, well, that's great news, but obviously
but
it's going to
hang
around.
But they can't succeed on the vaccine. This is the point you're making.
That's
okay?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's going to be around for as long as... That does take money. So we've got the World Health Organization has set up a program, the COVID program, which supposedly ensures vaccines reach countries irrespective of their income, they say. And they've got 200 countries that have signed up to it, which is more than 90% of the world's population. Sounds good so far, doesn't it? And they say they're going to invest and pool their resources to buy up the vaccines so they'll be available to everyone no matter where they live. So the rich countries can pay as a sort of a self-insurance policy to ensure that they get the vaccines they need, although most of them have done a fairly good job of doing that without the World Health Organization. So they can be self-financing, is the term they use it in this program. The rest are funded by contributions from public and private donors. So where do you see a problem with that?
Well, how much money is there?
It's the part where the rest is funded by contributions from public and private donors. They just said they have a budget this year of $6.8 billion. To buy up the vaccines they need. They've secured 1.1 billion doses, which is obviously nowhere near enough. $6.8 billion budget. They've only got a shortfall of $6.4 billion.
Yeah.
So, I don't know how they fixed that problem.
Well, here we come back to the sins of the father being visited upon the sons. One of the ideas of Bretton Woods in Keynes's version was by having a non-national currency as the currency of international trade, the bancor, and by having rules to constrain the degree to which surpluses could be run up by countries running surpluses, taxes on them, in effect, to help development, there would have been an enormous fund of bancor available to pay for what the International Monetary Fund was supposed to be, International Clearinghouse. Those funds would have been available to pay for a vaccine if we'd got ourselves into the situation in that alternate universe. But because we haven't, this is the one case where you simply have to borrow money or get given money to buy it because you can't pay for these vaccines, with your domestic currency if you're not running a trade surplus in the first place. And it's a reason to have international aid and to have largesse, and it's not going to happen. There's going to be that huge shortfall, so the vaccinations won't get as widespread as they should be in Africa and in India and in Latin America and the poor parts of Asia. And Thailand will do a very good job. So we're going to have the breeding grounds for COVID 19 to give us COVID 22 and COVID 25 and so on.
For which our existing vaccines will be useless.
Yeah, well, potentially. I mean, the odds, there are some, you want to get a vaccine which is attacks parts of the virus that have to stay the way they are for the virus to exist. And that, the parts that target the spike protein aren't necessarily going to be successful because we're seeing the British version and the South African version change the spike and make it more effective. And one of the vaccines has been bypassed by that particular piece of evolution. But yeah, this has to be treated as a global problem. And we're not set up as a global community.
Now, it might not be best in terms of the local economies, but if you look at the way the Chinese have rolled out the Belt and Road Initiative, where they basically invest money into infrastructure in overseas countries, and then they employ Chinese workers paid in Chinese yuan to work in those factories so that, it's basically money that's generated in their own local currency, even though it's applied overseas. Could we do the same sort of thing? Could we say, well, okay, let's build production facilities around the world, and the US will fund some of it, and the UK will fund some of it, and it'll be with money that we've created in our own economies, rather than having to pay money into these. Then it becomes part of our own circulating currency, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what you would want to have is. Building out the facilities to produce vaccines on the scale necessary domestically in each of those countries or regions. I mean, in Africa, you wouldn't want to have every country in Africa, but in India, you would want to have India having at least one facility to produce its own vaccines. And you don't want that to then mean that India's got to go cap in hand to the World Bank for a trade deficit. So it is one of those things where you want to, in a sense, costlessly give them the technology. I've got a few friends who work in vaccines. I want to talk about that at some point in the next few podcasts. But I have no idea what's involved in a vaccine factory. That's the same degree that I have an idea of what's involved in a semiconductor factory. But something that lets them build those on scale. On volume, yeah. we that's necessary. Distribution, most of these countries can cope with it because they have already got their networks for distribution. It comes down to the temperature issue. Do you have to freeze the stuff and so on? And that makes it much more complicated.
Yeah. There's only one really it's really just the Pfizer vaccine, isn't it? The BioNTech one that needs to be stored at minus 70 degrees. I mean, if you look at the AstraZeneca one and most of the others, they're cheaper and they can be stored between 2 and 8 degrees. So it's so distribution is obviously a lot easier for that. A little less efficient. It's that whole efficacy. So the BioNTech is 95% efficacy, whereas the others are less. But it costs $14 per dose. If you look at the AstraZeneca, it's $5, and it can be stored in much colder. Cooler temperatures, so easier to distribute. But if you did say, well, okay, the UK, because it would be a lot. So if you, even at that $5, you're gonna have two shots. So that's $10 times whatever it is, 7 billion people around the world. It's a lot of money still. So those costs, if they're paid for by the West, say the UK says, well, we're going to pay a chunk of that. We're going to contribute 10 billion, for example, out of our own currency to, and that money goes overseas into these foreign plants. What impact does that have materially on the UK economy? This is to explain it to a country that's just cut foreign aid in half because it doesn't want to see money going out of the country.
Yeah, that's definitely handing over some of its own productive capacity to do that, because you give somebody UK pounds, effectively you're saying, here's a certificate you can use to get stuff from the UK. So normally you do that in exchange for, you're buying Indian textiles in return for your UK pounds. But here you're saying, here are the pounds, we don't want any textiles back. So you're handing over buying capacity against UK production capability on a global market, that the money can end up being transferred into other currencies and global, foreign exchanges. I've no illusions about the money being directly used back in the UK again. But you are handing over part of your productive capacity. What you're saying is, we are sharing our capability to produce these with you using a financial means.
But we've been in an era where we've been creating money, like it's going out of fashion anyway. So even if we are handing it over, I mean, we'll still be handing over money, say, well, we want to buy stuff from you, so can we do that too? But this is, is this really any different to, well, I guess it is very different to using it to create money to support people in the UK, because you'd hope those people are going to spend that money in the UK. That's your point, isn't it?
Whereas it's not going to be spent domestically, it's going to be spent internationally,
So, but we should do this, shouldn't we? I mean, this is the only way. I mean, there's no alternative other than the fact that we all have to take some sort of economic hit. But if we are, in countries that have control over our own currencies, it's not a big issue, is it? It's not as big an issue as most people would see, that it's money spent that we have to pay back.
Yeah, it's an economic hit. If you don't take it, you take a much bigger one later. So, like, it would have been feasible, for example, to Texans to have insulation, well-insulated houses, but it was cheaper to keep them cool by not insulating them, and then, bang, you get hit by global warming and you freeze to death.
Unless you travel to Mexico. Unless you go on holiday to Mexico.
That's true. That does. Cancun's a nice part of the world this time of year, I hear. And again, the UK has economized by running down the NHS, which has worked really well when you ran out of personal protective equipment during a pandemic. So you have to, this is part of building resilience, not efficiency. And I think that we're now seeing a huge mistake on believing that efficiency is a form of resilience. No, it's not. It's a form of being tailored to the current situation. And if you get a drastic change in that situation, then you are toast by being too efficient. You need to have excess capacity everywhere to cope with the unexpected.
If you've got an outflow of money, though, so if Britain pays a whole chunk of money, even if it's money that's created, to start funding operations in India and other parts of the world, that's a big outflow of money for the pound. Does that change our exchange rates? How does it influence the money markets?
I think it would. This is when I disagree with MMT on this whole way they analyze money. So I think you're going to be increasing a trade deficit, which is, to me, it's a negative for the sustainability of the economy, but it's a necessary negative in this situation, because the negatives of not doing it could be far worse if the result of not vaccinating Africa or the poor parts of Asia was a return of a much more virulent virus in 2 or 3 years time.
So we need agreement then, because I mean, what you obviously one country, you're saying it's going to be detrimental to whichever country does this, so it's got to be shared, hasn't it? So the West has got together
effectively. Yeah,
but is it harder for the EU to do it, given that they are a mix of different countries? I mean, well, it's not harder, is it, except for the fact they've got to agree amongst themselves that they're going to be pardoned.
They've also got the 60% limit on government debt, which stops them doing this.
Yeah, I mean, seems to be being ignored at the moment, though, doesn't it?
Oh, it's total nonsense. I mean, you look at I think Greece is now running at 160% of government debt, and even Germany's rising. So you know, the Maastricht Treaty and the Treaty of Lisbon are looking like the total jokes they always were at the moment, in the face of two major crises in 1 decade, the global financial crisis and now COVID.
So,
but yeah, they're going to be slow getting off to the mark and doing it, definitely.
Yeah, but we've got to be quick, and that's the problem, isn't it? So the World Health Organization is saying, well, okay, we can secure all these doses and we can do more, but the big problem is funding. We've got this big gap, and that's because they're looking for donations. So what the World Health Organization should be doing is coordinating contributions as a proportion of GDP from the or some other measures from the wealthiest nations.
And that's what Bancor was set up to do. Yeah. The original Bancor proposal would have enabled that straight away.
Well, we're not going to do that this year, though, are we? So the only way is for them to actually get some a bit more determination and try and drive influence through all of these countries to say, yes, you need to support it, otherwise we're stuck with this thing for a generation or more.
And now, of course, because that's not going to happen, and pardon me, depressing. Yeah, but that if it doesn't happen, then it means we're going to get too low a level of vaccination in Africa and Asia. And then the question is, what's going to happen with this virus over time? Will this is one reason that Yanir Bayam made such a strong call. To those who don't know his name, he's one of the people who led the eradication of Ebola in 2014, or the containment of Ebola. And he said, you've got to go for eradication. It's got to be a global thing. So this whole idea of saving the economy by, going light on this virus is just giving it time to come back and hit us at a later stage. And we may see another wave of this particular virus in, you know, with evolutionary overloads in the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, are we going to go?
I'm certainly hoping we won't. But yeah,
are we going to go down the road in that case of we may be saying we're not going to do it now, but are we going to go down the road of vaccine passports? Are we going to say, well, okay, you can't come into this country unless you've shown us the demonstrated to us that you've actually been vaccinated? You know, and maybe not just for COVID, over time for other diseases as well. Are we all each individual nation is going to start cocooning themselves and maybe having travel corridors between places, the developed nations that are well vaccinated, but we're just going to cut ourselves off from the rest of the world?
Yeah, and they were the only country that's going to come out of that in any powerful, successful way is going to be China, because they've done successful eradication and they've got their own virus vaccine manufacturing capability, and they'll do very nicely. Russia as well, actually, by the looks of what they're doing with their vaccine, and also their success, relative success compared to the UK, in restraining the virus now. So, yeah, they are.
But that is not good for the global economy if we start stopping travel.
I think this is the end of globalization. Okay, this is the end of it. I think the beginning of the end of globalization.
You do sound like a strict headmaster sometimes, you know. This is the end of now.
I'm not at all. My personality is completely.
This is the end of globalization. Now stop it. But do you think? Do you think?
Nibble, leave Orifice alone. Yeah.
But do you think so? I mean, because of our own selfishness, that we actually can't see that eradication is the answer, and we actually do need to take some sort of economic hit in the short term to go for this global eradication. Or do we believe that global eradication is too big a call? It's just too impossible to achieve. Is that perhaps in the back?
Well, that's the usual cost-benefit analysis that economists fall for, which the whole idea of cost-benefit analysis implies you can actually measure them accurately in the first place, which is always dubious, and that there's no evolutionary process going on. And this is, I'm sorry, this is a virus. It evolves. So doing something which does minimization, not eradication, is just giving it an opportunity, indeed a pressure, to evolve to become a problem again in the future. Sometimes you don't necessarily Imagine what had been done in the Second World War if that were the case. How much do we need to fight the Germans to stop them actually affecting us all that badly versus how much do we need to defeat the Germans? And in this situation, chuck cost-benefit analysis in the garbage bin and eliminate the damn thing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, they won, but not by much. So we'll only speak German part of the time.
70%, 33% of the time. Yeah. One third German.
And I'm never going to finish a plate of sauerkraut either. You forget that idea. So I wonder then, you say a cost-benefit analysis is never going to work for this, but maybe it would because, if you're sensible with the cost-benefit analysis, you look at the various scenarios and you take a worst-case and a best-case scenario and I guess your point is that you then choose one in the middle, whereas, in fact, what we should be doing is looking at the worst-case scenario. But that would be fairly easy to do a cost-benefit analysis for, wouldn't it? Because you just take...
There's more scenario analysis you need to do. And cost-benefit literally thinks you can convert everything into dollars, and if it comes out plus one, you do it. If it comes out minus one, you don't.
Yeah. But you could do that because in this scenario, the worst case scenario would be that there would be a severe downturn in the global economy because there wouldn't be globalization, that we would have less trade globally as a result, and that is going to go on for generation after generation versus short term impact in investment in vaccines. I mean, it would be a fairly clear case to make, wouldn't it?
Well, not the way economists do cost-benefit analysis.
No, let's not get an economist do it then.
That's a great idea.
I am just finding it incredulous that we find ourselves in this situation where the World Health Organization is there trying to procure the vaccine with no way of paying for it.
It's actually begging on street corners, effectively,
to
get the money needed.
Yeah.
When the whole idea of the World Health Organization was to improve the health of the world and to coordinate global responses to global challenges, here it is in a situation it's got to go with a begging bowl to get pretty much 90% of the money it needs to do its job.
Yeah. The United States wasn't even a signatory to this until Biden came into power, actually. In fact, Donald Trump specifically said that they shouldn't be part of this coordinated effort because it was obviously the attitude of the world has become very much all to do with your own sovereignty. And that's the problem, isn't it? This has come at precisely the wrong time, just as the world was becoming much more insular. This has come to say, hey, this is what sovereignty can do for you.
Yeah. I mean, the only sovereignty that works here is total isolation. And the countries that have done that successfully, Australia being one of them, New Zealand, Taiwan, Thailand, they can be relaxed about this. But, where it's too big a country to be able to manage that. So India is the classic there. Even though they've been successful there, they'll never be able to eradicate, I think. All the ones that have bungled it completely, they're the ones who are paying.
Yeah. But you know what? I mean, there will be a lot of people who are saying, well, look, so long as we're vaccinated, that's fine because, as you've said yourself, places like India seem to have been containing it fairly well. So containment might be all we need. But it doesn't stop it, does it?
No, and particularly when it's this, and the whole thing, whenever I read people about, doing this cost-benefit stuff on, living with the virus, blah, 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 they're leaving out how fast it grows. How contagious it is. It can double every 2 or 3 days. And what that means is if that happens at any point in time, then within 2 or 3 weeks, your health system is overwhelmed. And you start, your health workers then die. Not every, it's not the proportion would die if we're talking about Ebola levels of mortality, morbidity here, but you still lose a large part of the infrastructure you need and you're damaged for the future. And that's the thing that we haven't got ourselves around. So we really, the governments of the world should have no question but to give the World Health Organization all the money it's asking for to enable the whole planet to get vaccinated.
Mm. Which probably is not going to happen. So the only hope we've got is that this thing mutates itself to such an extent that it actually becomes less infectious and less harmful. It could become just as infectious but less harmful. And we live with it in that way. But that's a big risk, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe we should talk to some of the people in our Patreons cycle who are working in biomedical research, and they can talk about what the odds are of that over time.
Yeah. Well, talk to experts. Jesus.
Yeah.
This.
What a radical thought.
I know. There's a whole new direction for this podcast, apart from your good self, of course, Steve. All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. Yes, because we are getting into an area that we know nothing about. Another podcast finishing with a rather grim outlook, unfortunately. We've got to turn it around sometime. We've got to. When are the happy times going to return, Steve?
We have to sing on the bright side of life at the end of one of the podcasts.
Yeah, as we nail you to a crucifix, perhaps.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Definitely nailing you to a crucifix now.
Bye-bye.
Well, look, by the way, just after we finished recording that, he said this.
Yeah. My voice is improving, I think, as I get older, by the way, weirdly enough. Anyway.
What do you reckon? Anyway, that's it for today. Back with another one next week. I'm Phil Dobby. Thanks for listening.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Yeah, that'll do. Get off.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.